Good morning, Your Honors. Can I reserve 3 minutes, please? For the record, Shelby Limmel of Masters Law Group here on behalf of John Gregory. Two quick points before I jump immediately into the issues on the prenuptial agreement. The first is just to mention that review is de novo, and I mention that only because it's a family law case, and that's unusual, but it is ultimately a contract interpretation. The second is to ask the court to please be mindful of the recitals in this agreement. And I point the court to the recitals in the prenuptial agreement because I think this is really where the trial court got headed in the wrong direction. In entering a finding that this agreement was entered for the express and sole purpose of creating community property, and that is not true. And pointing
Does
the court,
it matter what the purpose was?
Sure, because it matters what the party's intent is when they enter the agreement.
I mean, if the language is plain in paragraphs 1D and in paragraph 3, do we care what the purpose was?
I think the party's intent is manifested in the agreement is always relevant. I think this is where the trial court
well,
got headed in the wrong
direction.
We generally
have some rules that say if the language is unambiguous, that ends our inquiry, and we interpret the contract in accordance with the unambiguous language, and we don't go looking to other things that evidence intent.
I'm not asking the court to look outside the contract. I'm asking the court to be mindful in its de novo review interpretation of this contract that it has two purposes, and one of them is to preserve separate property. And that is abundantly clear from the recitals in this contract. The first thing this contract does is create community property. It takes three things that are separate and turn them into community property, and that's an account, two cars, and a house. The next thing it does is say everything else is separate and everything else is preserved as separate property unless it's converted. Now, those conversions happen on the anniversaries of the marriage, and that's the first question before the court is, what is an anniversary of the marriage for the purpose of creating a community estate? And our argument is that these parties are absolutely not intending to have a, quote, anniversary of the marriage when they're 2 months away from a court to divorce and, in fact, are in court battling out discovery sanctions.
Paragraphs 5A and B both conclude with a sentence. The date of determination of the amount of this obligation shall be the date that either party separates from the other with the intention that the separation be permanent, which shows that the parties contemplated there could be a date of separation while there was still a marriage in place. How would you write an opinion that explains the presence of those two sentences and those two paragraphs and the absence of any corresponding or analogous provision in the conversion provisions of paragraph 1B?
Because they're completely different provisions. Paragraph 5 is dealing with the situation in which the parties come before the court for dissolution when they haven't yet created community property because no conversions have occurred. And so it's defining dissolution in that context. That is a distinctly different situation than creating community property as the marriage continues. And that is what the conversion provision is. And there doesn't have to be a termination clause.
Isn't this provision in 1D self-executing?
It's self-executing and self-terminating. If there's no anniversary of the marriage, there is no conversion.
All right. And is there a marriage up until the date the decree of dissolution is filed?
No, the marriage is defunct. And under the law, there is no marriage.
There are state cases where, involving homestead exemptions, I think, where the question was whether or not parties were still married in a situation where there had actually been a trial but no decree signed, and the parties were still married. And certainly you wouldn't be free to remarry until a decree is signed.
Yeah, I'll agree that they're married. The marriage still exists. But are they having an anniversary in any real sense when they both acquiesced in the marriage being over? No, they're not. And not in any common sense definition of anniversary.
Where the court has applied the defunct marriage concept that didn't involve the rights of third parties?
In virtually every dissolution, the court determines when the marriage is defunct if there's an argument about
but I mean, in our reported decisions, we say there was no, for example, there's no community liability when husband incurred this debt because the marriage was defunct at that time because the parties have been separated. And what we're concerning ourselves with there is the right of the third party to get at property of the non-contracting spouse. And we use the defunct marriage concept to avoid the result that would otherwise obtain under Title 26.
But it often applies in cases where there isn't a third party present, and the only issue is what are the assets before the court.
Can you give an example of a case?
I can't cite a case, Your Honor, but in nearly any dissolution case, there is a question about when is the marriage over, because from that point forward, what you earn is your separate property, and what I earn is my separate property, and it's a common question in dissolution cases that don't involve third parties. Now, all I'm saying here, and I need to turn to the second issue, is that when you enter an agreement saying both of us, not just my client, but both of us agree to take our separate property and give it to a community on a date certain, you're not contemplating that you will be doing that when you are headed for a divorce, you haven't lived together in 9 months, you're in court battling out discovery sanctions, counseling has failed, you haven't even lived under the same roof. That's not an anniversary in any real sense of the word. Turning then to the second issue, and this is the community property joint accounts. It's undisputed that these accounts were created by operation of the agreement when the parties married, and that's at Clerk's Papers 501. This is conceded at the brief of respondent, page 5, 10, and 14. There is a community joint account from the date that these parties married moving forward, and my client repeatedly, as the court found at Clerk's Papers 444, put separate property into that account. That is a conversion of his separate property to the community. All that is required to accomplish a conversion is a redesignation of title, and he redesignates title of his separate property by taking it from a Merrill Lynch account and putting it into an E-Trade account that Ms. Gregory undeniably had access to for the entire duration of the marriage. There is no basis for concluding that that is a gift to the community. And if you look at the language of the provision that requires the parties to set up this agreement, which they undisputedly did, that contemplates a funding of a pool of assets coming into that account. It contemplates that when those assets run down, the parties will then use their separate income, and all income is separate under the prenuptial agreement, to then replenish the account. And it contemplates gifting. And gifting occurs.
Would you agree that at the time of those deposits, there were insufficient funds in the joint account to pay the living expenses?
Yes, and the parties knew that that would occur until conversion started.
And the provision of paragraph 3 says that in the event there are insufficient funds, then each party shall contribute to the community joint account an amount necessary to pay the expenses, and that if either party uses separate property to pay the ordinary necessary living expenses, and it's deemed a gift. I've paraphrased.
Mm-hmm.
When you come back on rebuttal, maybe you can explain why the court misapplied that.
I'll actually go into my rebuttal time if I can address that at this juncture, because it's an illogical interpretation of that provision to say that you both gift to the community by spending your separate property on community expenses, and that you also gift to the community by retitling your separate property and putting it in that community joint account. That retitling is the conversion that is required, and you have to go back to paragraph 1D. The only thing that is required to make a conversion is to retitle the asset, which is exactly what happens by placing it in that community account. Thank you.
There'd be a difference. Think about this for rebuttal. If the deposit had been one-tenth of the remaining separate property rather than some amount necessary to pay living expenses. Yeah, I don't expect you to answer that now.
Right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Valerie Villison for the respondent. Jennifer Gregory. The trial court properly interpreted the prenuptial agreement. Anniversaries still occur even when the parties are separated. The husband is taking too narrow of a reading of the definition of anniversary. And if you look at page 22 of their brief, they use a definition from Merriam-Webster. And it's not just a matter of a date that you celebrate, a special occasion that occurred on prior dates. It's you remember a notable event that occurred in the years prior. So even though the parties may have been separated and may not have been celebrating their wedding date, they certainly remembered it happened.
Is memory even required? Isn't it just a way of counting time?
Yes. I mean, it has nothing to do with whether or not, they're celebrating their anniversary. The prenuptial agreement is clear that marriage terminates on four events: death of a party, divorce, annulment, or legal separation. None of that happened by the time.
What's your view of counsel tells us that we should pay more attention to the recitals in this agreement than the trial court did, and that they should guide our interpretation?
I don't think the recitals are relevant to the interpretation of this agreement. As you look at 1D, the language is plain. If the parties intended that once they were separated, once someone files for dissolution, they could have easily included that language there. I mean, if you look at CP 489, it says, starting on the sixth anniversary, 10% of separate, I'm paraphrasing, 10% of separate property shall convert to community property each year, period. They could have written 10% of separate property shall convert to community property each year until the parties separate, until someone files for dissolution. That language is not there, and the trial court properly rejected the idea of adding that language to an agreement that the parties did not deem fit to include in the first place when they entered the agreement. This is exactly the same.
Well, another way of couching the other side's argument is to read the word marriage as viable marriage or functioning marriage or something analogous to that, and that the word marriage doesn't include that period of time between the practical dissolution of the relationship and the legal dissolution of the relationship by a court.
Well, certainly the parties knew how to phrase that language because they did it under 5A and B for within the first 5 years. And they said, when you know, if the parties separate with the idea that you know it would be permanent, then certain things would happen within the first 5 years. They didn't use that language in the other provisions. And one thing I want to make clear, this prenuptial agreement, but for these guaranteed conversions until the marriage terminates, it was highly favorable to just the husband. Without those, this would not have been a substantively fair agreement. Because to be clear, and this is the purpose under the estate cases where they say just because your marriage, you know, you're separated because you filed a dissolution does not mean you're giving up any valuable contractual rights. That was an estate of Lyman. It doesn't abrogate your existing property rights. And what the wife had at the time the husband filed for dissolution was a contractual right under the prenuptial agreement to have these guaranteed conversions happen on the anniversary of their marriage.
Would it have made any difference if the husband, before trial, had gone in and asked on summary judgment for the court to declare the marriage defunct?
No.
Another thing that used to happen when cases had trouble getting to trial quickly in King County is there was something called a bifurcated dissolution.
Correct.
A decree was entered, so the status was changed, and all the other issues were reserved for later. Would that procedure have been available here?
Certainly. The problem with this case from the start was it was never clear whether the husband wanted this agreement enforced or not. So to the extent it got dragged out till February 2016, this is equally on his end. Because if you look at his petition for dissolution at CP2, when it talks about like how the property should be divided, he didn't say enforce the prenuptial agreement. He said it should be divided by the court at a later date. And up until, you know, he filed a summary judgment in January 2016, you know, 3 months after their 10th anniversary date, to have the agreement held enforceable, and then he abandoned it. And then at trial, he said, you shouldn't enforce the agreement at all. But I do want to get back to the recitals only in the prenuptial agreement, just to be clear as to why this was a valuable right to the wife, these conversions. She gave up what could, in exchange for that, she waived any property rights she would have had
so
to that 12-point...
The intimate relationship argument disappeared.
Because $12.8 million almost entirely came from Google stock options that fully vested entirely during the period that they lived together permanently. He was hired in 2001. Those didn't start vesting until 2002. And the preamble in the prenuptial agreement acknowledges that they had been living together, which they signed in 2005. They had been living together for 3 years. So during that entire period, that $12.8 million, she could have claimed, right? I mean, she gave up making the argument saying that it was all community property, and rather than getting...
Would she have received a valuable right even if the conversion only continued so long as they lived together as husband and wife?
Which she agreed to, and what the agreement says is on the anniversary of each marriage.
I understand that, but it seems to me that your argument should flow from the language of the paragraph, and what she didn't give up doesn't really help us answer what the paragraph means.
Well, I think the paragraph means exactly what it says. On the anniversary, starting with the sixth anniversary, certain conversions will happen on the anniversary of the marriage date. Just because there is a dissolution pending does not mean that marriage date and that anniversary doesn't happen. It was a notable event that they remembered, and that's what she got. And this idea that, you know, she could have been foot dragging to drag, I mean, that's the nature of this agreement. I mean, arguably, she could have filed...
Did you have an anniversary of a marriage after divorce?
Yeah. I mean, you could acknowledge that exists, but not for this prenuptial agreement, because it's
How
clear.
Would we know that? I mean, the court enters a decree. What words here say that the paragraph 1D7 doesn't apply anymore?
Because then you move into paragraph 5, which talks about the dissolution of how property gets divided. So, it's, again, like community property agreements. You know, once a dissolution happened, it becomes ineffective. But during the marriage, even while a dissolution is pending, and the CPA agreements in Bachmeyer, Lyman, and Cato, that's exactly what the issue is, whether the vesting portion of the community property agreement, when one spouse dies, and then all of the community vests in the surviving spouse, whether or not that vesting provision is still valid, even though the marriage is defunct. And this court, the Supreme Court, Division II, have all said yes, you know, the fact that it's defunct. And then for the remainder of the time, I'll address the payment of expenses.
One quick question before you go there. What about the argument that, you know, 1D is a completely different purpose, these ongoing conversions from paragraph 5, which is at dissolution, here's what we're going to do, here's how it works. So that difference in purpose makes the use of language in one not so glaring as absence in the other.
Well, I think it's because under D, it's like if they didn't reach their fifth anniversary, there were no conversions under 1D. So all you had was... You had nothing, essentially, so because there was no conversions. But if they were to divorce, let's say, you know, in the fourth year, then you go to that language, and then you have to determine, you know, how much property you should get, $2 million or 20% of his separate property, whichever's less. And that's based on, you know, when they separate. And that's specific language under that occurrence, which is not in 1D, and could have been if that's what the parties agreed to, but that is not what the parties agreed to.
Get to your second issue.
Okay. In terms of the payment of community expenses, I'll just say a few things. One, it's unclear how these expenses were paid for because he never converted the community property. So to the extent they were being paid, is commingled. You know, if there's community property, had it been transferred, there would have been gains, there would have been income, there would have been earnings. All of that was commingled in the separate property Merrill Lynch account. And to the extent he paid community expenses from it, that's what he paid with it. And also, the agreement contemplated they might not be doing these contemporaneous conversions. And they said that was fine. But community expenses should be paid out of a joint account. And if there's not enough money in a joint account, the parties contribute their separate property. And if they do so, it is a gift. It's a gift, and they don't get a lien. You know, their separate estate doesn't get a lien against the community. And likewise, the community lien doesn't get reduced because they were paid that way.
Well, it doesn't really say they contribute separate property. It says they contribute to the community joint account an amount necessary to pay such expenses in proportion to each party's respective separate income from all sources. It gives a measure from separate income, but it doesn't say that's the source of the amount.
Well, I would say to the extent they don't have enough funds in the community account, then all they had was separate property. And that's what they would contribute. And it says, you know, the spouse will not have any rights as a lien holder against the community. So presumably, if it was their community property, they wouldn't need that language. So presumably, it was their separate property, and their separate estate wouldn't have a lien against the community. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I'll give you 3 minutes. We went over a little bit.
Thank you. Judge Leach, let me go back to your question about whether it matters, whether it was a 1/10. And I believe the question was the whole conversion
right.
versus what was necessary. It doesn't, and the reason it doesn't matter is there's a lien in place. Now, admittedly, the agreement doesn't expressly say you can make a partial conversion or you can't make a partial conversion. What it says is that if the conversion isn't made, that there's a lien in place.
Well, you certainly agreed to an easier claim for your client to make if he had taken 1/10 and put it into a community account.
It'd be cleaner. It would certainly be cleaner. And actually, I want to address another question you raised before I go into the second issue, and that was if an anniversary is just a remembrance of an event, isn't there always an anniversary? Of course. 5 years after these people are divorced, there's still a, quote, anniversary of the marriage, and it would be patently absurd to say that they're still making conversions at that point. Well, it's no less absurd to say that they're creating a community estate when 9 months after the date of legal separation is found by the trial court, 9 months after my client files, and they're in court battling it out, that they're nonetheless having an anniversary in any real sense of the word. And it creates a legal problem as well. It's not just, does that make sense? Is that reasonable to think that what these parties were contemplating? There is no community at that point. So legally, what the trial court said and what this court would be saying is that two people who are operating under agreement for the purpose of creating community property are doing that when no community exists. And it is impossible, as this court has previously held, to create community property when the community has ceased to exist. And then I want to turn then to this community property account. We've got the account. It's conceded that it's open. It's conceded that it's been open and that both parties have access to it. The only question is, what is the nature of the money coming into that account? That money, there is no source of funds to go into that account if it's not the retitled separate property. There is no other way to fund the account. Everything is separate under this agreement until the parties convert their separate property to the community. Now, that account clearly has to be funded by something, and this is the only way to do it. And the reason I say it has to be these conversions and not a gift is for two reasons. One, it's because this provision contemplates gifting, and it's different. It's not money that goes into the account. It's money that's spent for community expenses outside of the account. So what the trial court did is to ask this court to accept that my client and the other party, if she had had a job and had any income during the marriage, were creating community property together, but then they were setting that aside and they weren't using it to operate as a community, and instead were then making additional gifts of separate property to the community, despite the fact that this account mechanism contemplates that gifting will only occur outside of the operation of the account. That is the epitome of an absurd interpretation of this contract, and I ask the court to reverse.
Thank you both very much.